lebe ein gewöhnliches Leben auf eine außergewöhnliche Art und Weise. Dieses Motto hat sich Rick Purcell vor vielen Jahren ganz groß hinter die Ohren geschrieben. Daraus hat sich eine wirklich außergewöhnliche Lebensgeschichte entwickelt, die Rick in seinen 20ern im Vietnamkrieg beinahe selbst vorzeitig beendet hätte. Willkommen bei 1000 First Steps, dein Podcast für das Größte in dir. Mein Name ist Jakob Horvath und meine Vision mit diesem Podcast ist es, dir Menschen, Lebensgeschichten, Impulse und Inspirationen näher zu bringen, die dich in deiner persönlichen und spirituellen Entwicklung einen Schritt weiterbringen. Rick Purcell ist so ein Mensch und nur in seiner Nähe zu sein, hat auf mich einen sehr positiven Einfluss gehabt, auf meine Emotionen, auf meine Denkmuster, auf mein Wohlbefinden, als wir uns in Bali kennengelernt haben. Und vergangene Woche haben wir im Podcast-Interview darüber gesprochen, wie wir als Menschheit den Sprung in eine neue Welt schaffen können. Und heute erzählt der Soul Coach und spirituelle Autor im zweiten Interviewteil aus seinem Leben. Es ist diesmal ein sehr persönliches Interview und ich freue mich sehr, das mit dir teilen zu können. Rick erzählt unter anderem, wie er im Vietnamkrieg zerbrochen ist und warum der größte Schmerz so eine wichtige Erfahrung für ihn war. Er beschreibt seinen langwierigen Heilprozess und erzählt, wie er es schafft, mit 73 Jahren als Vater von 2 10-jährigen Zwillingstöchtern immer noch so unheimlich jung zu sein. Ich hatte das große Glück, auf Bali 10 Tage lang mit ihm und seiner Familie zu leben, ihm jeden Morgen um 6 Uhr in der Früh im Garten zu helfen und mir dabei eine Geschichte nach der anderen aus seinem sehr beeindruckenden Leben, wie ich finde, anhören zu dürfen. Das Interview ist wieder auf Englisch. Ich reiche die Übersetzung nach, versprochen. Die wird es dann auf der Website www.1000firststeps.com zum Nachlesen geben. Und jetzt wünsche ich dir ganz viel Freude mit Rick Purcell.
Hello, Rick.
Hello, Jacob.
Hello. Happy to have you here on the podcast a second time.
I'm honored.
Yes, me too. When we met 1 week ago, we right away, like 2 hours later, did our first podcast interview because we spent a fair amount of these 2 hours that we got to talk after, right after we met, by you sharing your wisdom, you sharing your life experience, you sharing your projects, your visions. And I was so inspired that I instantly thought, wow, this is an amazing podcast interview partner. And you said, right away, let's do it. So as I stayed with you in your place now for a week in your heaven in Bali, in your retreat center, doing my meditation teacher training very close by, we got to talk a lot. We got to know each other better. And that inspired me a lot. And I thought this is worth a second interview. And definitely I would love to hear more about and share with our listeners more about your personal story. What is this guy about? How come a 73-year-old is so fresh and so active and so fun to be around? And yeah, let's talk a little bit about Rick. Who is Rick?
Okay. Well, it's not something I necessarily feel totally comfortable talking about myself.
Well, get out of your comfort zone.
Yeah, of course. But I'm happy to share. It's been an amazing journey. I've had my ups and downs, obviously, as one does. And now from this perspective, I know that we are creating our reality. We create our reality and they start with thoughts. And there is the bigger picture where it looks like there is an overall scheme to some things in our lives that unfold perhaps unbeknownst to us, unconsciously. But at the root of that, there is a conscious effort to become more conscious and become more aware of our awareness, become more conscious of our consciousness. So my whole journey has been on that. But of course, in my childhood and earlier years, I wasn't aware of that. So it appeared that life was just happening to me instead of through me. Mm-hmm. So, But my early childhood was on a farm in England. I had two beautiful pacifist, loving, kind parents, and they had broken away in a way from mainstream suburbia post-war to create a home on a remote area, a remote farm. And we grew our own organic vegetables before organic was known. We raised ducks and chickens and all sorts of stuff. There were horses on the property and ponds. It was an absolute idyllic location from my childhood. Woods to run through. I had a whippet dog run through the woods, free as a free spirit. My mum had total faith and trust in me that I would come home when I was hungry. In the meantime, I'm totally safe on this property. And it was a big property. And the canal ran through it. And in those days, they had these long boats where they were horse-drawn. And they're virtually gypsy sailors on them. And they were fascinating people. And I would walk along the side footpath and talking to these kids that lived on these barges and boats. So it was really a great childhood, and it was steeped in the value of appreciating nature, living free, no electricity. We had paraffin lamps and candles.
Wow.
No running water. We had to pump water from a well up into a holding tank. So it was very simple, humble beginnings. And by the time I was 11, we had a democratic poll to see where we would live, and we had two choices, Australia and Canada. All I knew about Canada was photographs in we had a set of encyclopedias, and there was a colored shot of some Mounties on horses with these beautiful red uniforms, and lumberjacks with red and black check shirt, which I have on now. And I thought, I'd love to be a Mountie, and in the weekends, I'd love to have a red and black check shirt. So I voted for Canada, and the other four voted for Australia. Australia it was.
Yeah.
And in hindsight, it was probably the best choice.
Okay, and you have your shirt now. So
I got my shirt. I still haven't been to Canada. Yeah. I've been all around the States, but haven't been to Canada
yet. How did Australia come along for you? How was that as a child, moving from such a very extraordinary surrounding, being in nature in this remote area, changing to the other side of the world?
Well, it was a huge change for us, and trying to adapt. It was 1957. It took 6 weeks to get there by boat, by ship, past Senegal, Cape Town, Durban, and across a long passage to Fremantle. And we were in a lot of ways unprepared, because in February we had freezing weather on the farm, and we were all lined up on the rail of the ship, and we could see the early morning sun coming up over the hills. And that day it was 32 degrees centigrade. And we were dressed in thick English clothes and jackets and everything. So the shock of the temperature was pretty extreme. Mm. We soon adapted into that, because we could swim where we were staying at an immigration hostel. We could walk down in the morning and swim in the river amongst the jellyfish, and walk back and burn our bare feet on the hot sand. And our food was completely different. And it was very, very basic living in this immigration center until we found our own place. Mm. And I was enrolled at a public school. My first day at school, I was taunted, because I was lily white and still, I really hadn't adapted clothes-wise too well. And at the end of the school day, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, some bullies, I went to the toilet. These are the old concrete urinals with a wall, and you peed against the wall, mm-hmm. and it went in an open drain, and God knows where it ended up in the end. And these bullies came in and started taunting me because of my British accent, and I was obviously an immigrant, didn't fit in. And they beat me up and threw me in the urinal.
Oh, wow.
So it's another day of over 30 degrees, and I had to probably 2 or 3 kilometer walk home.
Mm.
Bruised, battered, my ego shattered, bleeding a little bit, not a lot, and stinking of urine in over 30 degree temperature. Mm. And that was my first day at school in Australia. And I burst out crying when I saw my mum, and I said, "Mum, I want to go back to England."
What did Mum say?
She was very consoling. She said, "Let's get you cleaned up." And then she gave me a big hug and she said, "We'll work through this. Mm. We'll work through this." And we did.
Mm.
And she was such a compassionate woman.
Mm. Yeah.
And then I finished all my schooling and in Australia, and made the best of it. I didn't enjoy school. I didn't enjoy the breaking of lessons up into small quantities, and could never figure out why I needed trigonometry in my life or algebra, none of which I've used ever since I left.
I think many people have a hard time figuring that out.
Absolutely.
Even
today, yeah. Mm. And I excelled in the manual sports, woodworking I loved, metalworking,
mm-hmm.
technical drawing, English and history were my five subjects that I managed to scrape through to what was a junior certificate. And I told my dad, I don't want to go on after this. 15, I'm leaving. And I would become a keen motor racing fan with books and been reading all about it. And I said, "Dad, what I really want to do is race motor cars." And he said, "Well, in those days, you had either a rich daddy or you went down the hard route." And that was getting grease under your fingernails. And so I did an apprenticeship in those days, it was pretty good because it was an advanced automotive engineering. So I was working on some of the most advanced engines, single overhead camshaft engines, which had never been seen in Australia.
We're talking about the late 50s, early 60s now?
It would have been early 60s,
early 60s.
Mm-hmm. So Coventry Climax overhead cam engines, remote advanced diesel engines and all of that. And I did 5 years of that and graduated as an automotive engineer.
And you even worked in a Formula One, you said?
I developed two Mini Coopers and raced them. And then later on, I joined a Formula One team, Brabham Formula One team. I got to meet John Surtees, McLaren, all of those guys, which was wonderful. That was the culmination of my petrol heading. I gave it up after that. If I could recoup all every dollar I spent on cars between those years, I would be wealthy today. But it was fun.
Well, that's the passion of a young man.
Yeah. Exactly.
That costs usually some money.
Yeah. It also put some discipline because these cars were very fast, and we could put the number plates back on after one of these tuning days and racing days and virtually drive them on the streets, take the numbers off and drive them on. And you were allowed to do that, and they put an exhaust on it. And there was the days when drag racing at the traffic lights became very popular, and these hotted up vehicles would come up alongside you, and they would revving the engine, trying to torture you. And I would rev mine and just let them go. And all of my racing and hooning around was done on the racetrack, and very disciplined. And I didn't want to bring disrespect to the racing fraternity by, you know, drag racing on the roads.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a fun chapter of my life.
So there is this fun chapter, and there is these different phases in your upbringing, your childhood, the England chapter, the Australian chapter. And then something happened in your early 20s that has changed your life forever.
Sure, it did. The Vietnam War was going full strength, and Australia decided to send a token force of soldiers to Vietnam to support the US efforts. And the system of recruitment was done by lottery. They had all these marbles in a lottery and turned the barrel virtually and pulled out a marble. And then mine was, this one said the 2nd of May, right? And that was my birthday. So there were eight of us in playing music and a fledgling rock and roll band, long hair. And I was the only one that got called up.
You were a pacifist? Because yeah. Your parents were pacifists?
Pacifist. I didn't believe in war. And my name came up and I tried to do a bunk and get back to England, tried to book some passages to go back to England. And they said, no, you can't go. You've been in Australia. You're living here now. You are now obliged to go. So I very reluctantly showed up in Victoria from Western Australia in the Eastern States. And I'd had all my beautiful long black locks shaven off, short back and sides, and was confronted by a captain on the registration. And I said, sir, you need to know I'm a pacifist. My parents are pacifist. I don't believe in war. I don't believe in violence. And that's where I'm coming from. And he looks me in the eye and said, son, that's perfectly okay. That's not a problem. You'll just go to jail for 2 years. And that was the solution. And I am faced now immediately by the value that I had embodied all my life and been around. And do I want to sit in jail for 2 years, rotting away in some horrible jail, away from home? I don't know anybody in this state, so I have no connection with my family. And all my friends in Western Australia, we're talking, well, not quite 3,000 kilometers away, but a long way. They're all getting on with their lives. They're racing their cars. They're drinking their beer. They've got their girlfriends. They're getting engaged. They're building businesses. And I'm sitting in a jail rotting away. So I made a decision, a conscious decision, I would go. Right. And I told him, okay, I will be I'm a reluctant draftee, but I will go. And then the brainwashing happened, where we had said, this is when the US was terrified of Reds under the bed. This was the communist threat, the pseudo-communist threat.
What does it mean?
It means communism were called the Reds.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So you've got China that was a communist, Russia was communist governments. And that was the great fear of the US and democracy, that these groups would swell and take over the world. Mm-hmm. And the propaganda that we were inflicted with and I bought was that you've got all these communists in China. And if Vietnam falls, they will be coming down through Vietnam, Cambodia, into Indonesia, across to Australia. And you'll be fighting them on the beaches of Darwin, Bondi, and Cottesloe, where I lived. And I fell for it, hook, line, and sinker. Then I started to change my mindset because I knew I couldn't get out of this. It was 2 years. So I started to look at how can I make the best of this? And, okay, I'm a new Australian. I have a duty now to this new country that I've come to. And there is this peril, the yellow peril. I was really sucked in. So I went there and I just changed my mindset and I said, I dropped all the resistance and saw the way how the platoon, the group, inflicts the discipline on each other if you miss out. Because if one transgresses, everybody in the group gets punished. Mm-hmm. So there's a natural self-regulating process where you go and talk to the guy or they talk to you and say, listen, you better toe the line. Because we're doing a 12-mile force march because of you. Mm-hmm. So it's an incredible leveling factor.
Right.
And I started off resisting and as I saw the damage that I was inflicting on my colleagues. So I worked my way up to section commander. We did our training in Vietnam, for Vietnam, in a place called Canangra, which is G jungle in Queensland. Mm-hmm. We're still wet behind the ears. I did some advanced driving courses because I was a section commander in a transportation group. Mm-hmm. And we had to learn how to drive these six-wheel drives in all terrain, yes. What to do if the enemy hits you, all of that sort of stuff, convoying. And I finished up in a gun jeep with an M16 machine gun and RPG rocket ran, driving in an open jeep. And my job was to go up and down the convoy. And if there was, when we were hit, I would draw the fire. We would turn into the fire and draw the fire to this vehicle while these other vehicles carrying ammunition, people, food, mm-hmm. would get away without any, without getting hit. So very, very interesting 12 months. But very soon into my tour of duty, I realized we'd been hoodwinked. Nobody wanted to be there. The Australians, the token force of New Zealanders, didn't want to be there. The Vietnamese didn't want to be in war. The Viet Cong didn't want us there. The Americans didn't want us there. And
it was a war that nobody wanted.
Nobody wanted it except the military industrial complex, of course, and those that profit from war. Mm-hmm. And I struggled with every day with this value of mine. And we were hit many times. I was, as a section commander, I was responsible for keeping these guys. I finished up winning a couple of medals for bravery and what things that I did. So I really stepped up. I was going to do the best I could here.
How was that? I mean, like, what is it like to be a pacifist of this, like, don't believe in war and then still giving your all and doing your best? Is that just sheer survival instinct, so that you know when you give your best you have better chances to survive? Or have you been involved as much and brainwashed that you just said, okay, now I'm in?
It wasn't so much as doing the best to win the war, all right, or the opposition to the enemy, but do the best to keep these guys alive, mm-hmm. and do the best. It brought up my leadership qualities, mm-hmm. which I'd never had, and I'd never been in a position mm-hmm. to be a leader, and I stepped into that role. So that role was to look after, nurture, inspire, motivate these guys, and compassion, because the guys were lost and injured, and we're away in this foreign country. So I wanted to do my best as my personal best, but I still didn't believe in war, yes. And it was insane. I witnessed and participating in man's inhumanity to man, mm-hmm. the absolute insanity of war. Mm-hmm. And that was soul destroying. And I went through for 9 months of that. And I had married my sweetheart. I'd had 5 weeks with my sweetheart before I left to Vietnam. It was quite a sort of spontaneous thing. And after 9 months, she sent me a Dear John letter saying that she'd gone off with somebody else and she couldn't wait for me.
Ouch.
Which absolutely shattered me, because it was the dream of going back to her that kept me alive. That was the sole reason, looking after my troops. But at the end of the day, I'd go back to this girl that I loved. That night when I received this letter, I took my self-loading rifle out of the tent. It was a bright moonlit night in a bit of a clearing in the jungle. There was artillery going off and skirmishes going around us. And I sat down on the ground and I put the rifle butt into the ground and the barrel against my forehead and pressed the first spring of the trigger. And my intention was to blow my brains out, I could not see past this misery. This pain was so abjectly traumatizing that my dream, there was no future. There was no future there for me that I could see. And my way out was to escape. Mm. I wanted to escape the pain. And out of my tent, a mate of mine came out and he saw me sitting there. It was bright moonlit night, calm as a cucumber, sat opposite me and just looked at me. We were just confronting each other like we are now. And he calmly said, "How long have you been here?" And through the tears and the grief, I spluttered about 20 minutes. And he leant over and took the rifle out of my hand and ejected the bullet, put it down, and he pointed his finger at me and he said, "I know you, Perso. You've kept us alive for 9 months. You're direct. You're focused. You've led us. You're in control. If you were going to do this, you'd have done it 20 minutes ago." And he was right. Yeah. I was sitting on the fence, vacillating, you know. And we got up and we hugged and we sobbed and we shouted and we swore at the Americans and the Australians and the Viet Cong and everybody we could swear and project upon. And the next 3 days, I virtually had no sleep over 3 days and three nights. And I was contemplated what I was planning to do on that night. And I saw the absolute stupidity of it, that I'm 20-year-old kid, wet behind the ears, had had a beautiful life, but hadn't really had a lot of exposure to life. And so my wake-up call was from the universe, "Why don't you experience life? And then if you don't like it, do something about it. But right now, you know nothing," right? And that was the catalyst for me. This was an amazing aha moment.
That was still in the war?
I was right in the middle of it. Mm. I was still running convoys mm-hmm. and leading these mm-hmm. guys. But all the time, this heart-mind activity was going on. How can I turn this around? Mm. And it then came to me that I need to know who I am and what is my purpose and why am I here and what's the meaning of life, you know, and why is there war and why is there pain and suffering? And of course, I was in a Buddhist country and I had experienced for 9 months the inner calm of the Vietnamese, not so much the soldiers, but they're sometimes we transport young soldiers, 21 years of age, some as old as 14, that were tiny boys with guns going to the front, and their family would go with them and get food for them. So they would just be back from the front line. And I experienced this calmness about them. One occasion, there was a young girl breastfeeding a wee babe on the back of this truck. And we had eye contact, and it was just a momentary eye contact. And I saw this calm woman, and there's a new baby, and she is with a young husband. He was about 21, and we were going to the Cambodian border. And she was going to be somewhere getting cooking rice and feeding this man while he went out into the jungle. And there was this calmness about her, and there was a beautiful one-on-one connection. Mm-hmm. And so I immediately warmed myself for the philosophy of Buddhism and started learning about that and seeing it. The philosophy played a big part in my life mm-hmm. and shaped my life. So I came back from Vietnam totally broken, absolutely broken man, with nothing. My wife disappeared. I never saw her again. I went back to the same town that I lived in, and she'd gone mm-hmm. and never tried to contact me. Her family were very supportive of me, and my family was, but this woman had gone out of my life. And I was totally broken. And after a couple of weeks back there, my dad said to me, "We've missed you for 2 years, son. We worried about you every day. You know, I'm in a war and they're pacifists." Mm. They never, ever chided me for that choice or decision.
Must have been so hard for them, though.
I reflected back on it many times. I thought, what did they go through? Mm. Right? There's their boy in this jungle. You can only write letters, so there would be long delays in conversation. And they would see the media, and of course that was distorted, but there were often people coming back to Western Australia in a coffin, and they would know all of that. Mm. That would smack against their values, but they were so compassionate and understanding. And my dad saw the shape I was in, and he said, "Son, you know, you've always loved motoration. You've talked about going back to England and Europe, and maybe this is a good time to do it. We've missed you, but, you know, we know you'll be back, but it would be good for you to go and heal." And 2 weeks later, I was on a plane to London and settled in London and started my travels.
You traveled, I think, in a Volkswagen?
Yeah, bought a Volkswagen Combi, split screen, early model, bright orange color, decked it all out with psychedelic paintings and flowers and kangaroos and Australia written on the side, and decked it out as a camper van. And
sounds like you have found your way into the 60s hippie generation.
I'd found hippiedom. My only concern was I was immediately aligned with hippiedom, but my hair wouldn't grow long enough fast enough because it was shorn off from the army.
Right.
I got a job working at the manor house at this farm that we belonged to. I went back there. Mm-hmm. And they had some beautiful gardens. Mm-hmm. And I said, I would like to volunteer to work in the garden. Yeah. I don't want to be paid for it. But my parents up the road were very mm-hmm. Keen gardeners. And I would find this would be part of my healing process. Yeah. And then drove to Cornwall when I'd finished there, and had that magical healing process that mm. I went through, where 5 days and five nights, mm. screaming, flashbacks, mm. terror, and moments of stillness, where mm. I wrote exquisite poetry. A couple of other occasions I didn't, because I had no spiritual background and no religious background. I didn't know, I think, is this going to be my life? Mm. Right? Calm and trauma. Mm. And I was processing a couple of times. I thought, maybe I should end this. I don't know if this is going to be like this. I don't want it. You know? Mm-hmm.
What made the shift for you?
I didn't know at the time, but I was being guided through this process of healing. And it was diving, these flashbacks were for me to relive it and to really embrace it. And I was, to this day, I don't know, I couldn't give you a name of who guided me, but it was a benevolent force or being or beings, I don't know. Mm. But I was being guided through this process and shown both sides of the coin. There's your trauma, there's your pain and suffering, and there's the stillness and quietness when the other's not there. Mm. And that gave rise to some hope. And then after 5 days, on the fifth morning, I'm laying in my bunk, in my combi, no curtains, the sun's just coming through. And I'm looking out at the roof lining, I think, wow, it's gone. It's all gone. It's shifted from the unconscious into the conscious. And I laid there for 2 or 3 hours, recounting my entire Vietnam trip. Just everything from the day I got there to talking to this officer about not wanting to go, and all the trauma, all the violence mm-hmm. that I experienced, my own personal journey and trauma that I experienced after 9 months, and seeing one of my best mates. Everybody expected, the boys that went to Vietnam, that they would be killed. Mm-hmm. And one of my best mates, his whole family was wiped out. 2 kids, his mother-in-law and his wife were killed in a car accident. Mm. And this guy, he had no family to go back. And I was with him, and I'm consoling him. And they finally let him go back home. Normally, once you're there, you can't go. Mm. So all of these sins, and I went through it and witnessed it all. And it was all, there was no charge. And I've been back to Vietnam 5 times. Walked into a Viet Cong village mm. and and met my so-called enemy, only to discover they were brothers and sisters.
They were not enemies at all?
Not at all.
And was that the beginning of your spiritual journey, the release of this pain, or how could you describe
it? Yeah, I had already subscribed to, I need to find out who and what I am. And this was my first real experience where I was consciously guided through this process. Something happened, but I couldn't articulate it. I know what I experienced, but I couldn't articulate. How could I arrive? I didn't know anything about psychology or regression therapy. How could I arrive at this stillness, which was so profound and exquisite, at that point where there's zero charge? It's all gone. And nobody was counseling me. I was on my own. So there had to be some other force or some other energy that was
guiding you,
guiding me through it. Mm-hmm. So that was my first real conscious spiritual experience. Mm-hmm. And that catapulted me on my path more and more. Mm-hmm. And subsequently took me to India and all over the place, some beautiful teachers. Finished up here in a retreat center, sharing what I've learned.
Wow, yeah, and working as a life and spiritual coach, yeah, and working on this amazing project that you have introduced to us in the past episode, in the past conversation.
Yeah.
And it's just amazing to listen to this story, and it inspires me so much, because even though I have not even a clue what it must be like, what you've gone through in the war and all these things, but certainly I have experienced pain and suffering in some form. And to see the seed of awakening, the seed of life purpose in that suffering,
yes,
that gives me a lot of hope and trust in life. And how did you, like, when we talk about life purpose, because I think many people think about exactly that question.
Yes.
What am I here for? Who am I? Like, and where am I going? What is it? What is this all about? How do you find this life purpose?
Great question. And that's something that I do quite a bit in my coaching. I believe that every one of us has a life purpose, that we come into this incarnation to achieve something. And it's usually about giving to others. It's not necessarily selfless, but what we gain back is enormous. But it's not about ourselves. It's not about getting more money and bigger houses and faster cars. It's about what can I give to the us and we. The ego is all about I, me, and mine. So we're trying to attract an inward flow of energy. I want this. This is mine, right? And the opposite is us and we. So it's about collaboration and cooperation. So I believe that we all have that.
If you would put it in one sentence, your life purpose?
It's morphed into other things. For my retreats, I explained that it appears to be two of us, right? One that is filled with goodness and compassion and kindness, and one that tends to sabotage all of that. Mm-hmm. And I introduce people to the good kindness. I show them this other part. It's the black wolf, white wolf, mm-hmm, and how to live your life from the white wolf perspective. So I'm helping people to facilitating changes in people that will cause less harm in their lives and a more expansive, meaningful life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can you give an advice, a short one maybe, that helps people who are listening to resolve that inner conflict between the white wolf and the black wolf, between the strong and the weak, the good and the bad, like this inner conflict of ego and higher self?
Yes. Yeah. Well, whatever we're resisting will persist. And I demonstrated the other day, if we put our hands together almost like in prayer in front of our chest, right, and push, mm-hmm, against them.
Okay, pushing really hard now.
Yeah, pushing hard. Yeah. That is the inner conflict that we have.
Yes.
Right? If I take away my right hand,
yes,
right, and the left hand represents the goodness, right, The right hand represents the ego and fear. We take away the fear and there's nothing to push against. So the birthing of this higher self, this spirit, this whatever label we want, the goodness in our life that we all have within us, is not being resisted.
Right, but it
means it doesn't, we're not when we say take it away, it's still there.
Yeah.
And we embrace it and recognize it. This is anger, this is trauma, this is whatever it is. This is fear arising, this is separateness arising. This is superiority and judgment, cynicism, criticism. Mm-hmm. I'm not good enough, I'm never going to make it. All of that's coming from the ego. So we're recognizing that's it, but that's not who I am, right? Who am I behind the ego? Even who am I behind this soul is something that's infinite. So we have a body, but we're not just a body. We have a mind, but we're not just our thoughts. We have feelings and emotions, but we're not just those. We have even a life story. We're not the life story. We think of ourselves as a single spirit, but if I have a spirit and you have a spirit, there's more separateness.
Mm.
So everything is connected. And so...
coming from the same source.
The same source. So we're identifying... what the problem is not the ego and the fear and all of those content. It's our identification with it.
Mm-hmm.
So we're saying, I'm that.
Yes.
I'm an angry person. Mm-hmm. I'm never going to make it, all right? I feel ashamed of what I've done, right? And we identify that. Now we've misidentified our true self from an infinite being to saying, I'm a little nondescript, horrible little person.
A limited
And that's the limitation.
So the first step would be observation, becoming aware of one's own behavior, of thoughts, of emotions.
Yes. Yeah.
And doing the self-inquiry. Right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The definition of the ego is a false sense of self. So it's a lie. Right from the beginning, if we've created this false persona, it's a lie, it's a fabrication.
Yeah.
So what's the truth behind that? Well, the truth is, I'm an infinite being having a human experience. And there is goodness within me. There's compassion and understanding and forgiveness.
Are you doing this on a regular basis, the self-inquiry, like really thinking about going through your day and thinking about what have I done today? What could I do better tomorrow? What did I feel when I did this and that?
It's a constant process. Mm-hmm. By observing the behaviors, by nibbling away at the ego and not projecting it on people, and using the white and black wolf analogy, if you don't feed the black wolf, it'll eventually wither away. Mm. It won't die in our case, but it won't have anywhere near the projected effects on us. The ego reacts, the soul responds, the higher self responds.
Right.
So which wolf are we going to feed? Are we going to feed the fears of the ego, or are we going to feed the heart of love? And that's my daily choice.
That was so beautiful when I came down there. Since I'm doing the karma yoga here in your resort, in your retreat center, in your amazing garden, coming down at 6 o'clock when you already started your morning routine. I think you said 3 hours every day you do. This is your morning routine?
Sometimes it stretches to 9 or 8 or whatever. But usually on average about 3 hours, first thing in the morning, surrounded by fresh, renewed energy from the night. And we have all of these terraces that I'm growing organic vegetables on. And I weed, especially in the wet season, the weeds are pretty prolific. So we have these 5 big terraces, and I start at the top. I systematically go along the terrace and go to the next one and come back. And by the time I've got to the bottom one, I'm ready to start weeding again.
It gives you your morning practice.
Yeah.
But what I actually wanted to go with that was when I came down to help you on the terrace, you said, how has your day been so far? And my day was just 10 minutes old or 15 minutes old. I just did my some morning practice, some breathing, some meditation, and And you were like, so now we have this choice, this beautiful day. Do we want to fill it with love or with fear?
That's it.
And this is the first thing I hear from you in the morning. It's so inspiring being around you. I can't even put it in words.
Thank you.
And another thing that really inspires me is your, how young you appear, how fresh you seem to be in your mind, with your thoughts, with what you say, with your humor. You're making jokes all the time and laughing so much, and you can really see you truly person that is a great pleasure and a great gift to be around.
Thank you.
And I would love to ask you, what keeps you young? You're now 73 years old.
Yes, coming up to 74.
74, what keeps you young?
Fit and healthy. It's awakening the inner child, the innocent, the original innocent child before life started dishing out its knocks, before we got caught up in the egoic behaviors. It's tapping into our original innocence. And the child is obviously symbolic, but we have the wounded child that keeps perpetuating all of the drama and that in our life. Mm. But to look at how I was on the farm, a free-spirited young kid allowed to wander out for 7 or 8 hours with my dog, come back with an armful of wildflowers for my mum as a gift. Mm. And I can recall those days. And I was free, and this was before, I think I mentioned before, I was sexually abused by a pedophile uncle when I was 5. Mm. So even prior to that, there was that innocence. And I've relived that. I've recontacted that child within. Right.
How do you do that?
How I've been doing it on the retreats is I get people into an alpha meditative state and said, now I want you to move from your head to your heart, and I want you to build something in your heart. I want you to visualize and imagine a spectacular landscape that is natural. Maybe it's a cove, you're sitting on a hill, grassy hill, looking down onto this white sandy beach, if you love being on the ocean. For me, it's the view of the mountains. Maybe there's a waterfall, an eagle soaring ahead, or maybe you're in an Amazonian area that's just so pristine. You can either mock it up in your mind, or it's somewhere you've actually been.
So your happy place, your personal happy place.
Yeah. I call it the sacred space. The
sacred space. Right. Beautiful.
And then I walk them through this, and I walk them through all of the perceptions to imagine, what are you smelling here? Mm-hmm. Can you smell the grass? Can you smell the salt sea air? Can you smell the freshness of the foliage and the water? And what can you hear? Can you hear that eagle, bald eagle, soaring a thermal? Can you hear it crying out? Can you hear the rustling of the trees? Can you hear the waves lapping on the beach?
What does that have to do with my inner child?
Well, because it's fulfilling this role. This is your sacred space, and it's filled with everything that you love and brings you joy and peace and calm. Mm. And so it becomes, you're solidifying an idea into a real sort of concept. And you go all the way through. The last one is taste, right? You've just finished, there's a picnic basket on this where you're sitting, and you've just tasted your favorite fruit. Maybe it's a peach or a strawberry, and there's still a little bit running down your cheek, and you're just, or some walnuts. So we go through the 5 perceptions and said, now I want you to open up the 6th sense, right? And open up this channel to what is embedded in there. And then as you're looking out of this vista and feeling calm and relaxed, you notice some movement. And there's a child running towards you, but you can't discern who it is, right? If you're a girl, if there was a woman there, there's a girl, you can see her hair's falling back. You feel, you intuit this excitement and adventure about this kid and running and little skirts flying in the wind. And as she gets closer, you realize it's you. It's the little original innocent version of you.
That we all carry within us.
Yeah. And you've stood up before, and now you get down on your knees and you open your arms, and this little child runs, thuds into your chest, and you embrace them. You can feel the breath on your cheek and the warm, and our little heart is racing. And now you merge with her. It's a shamanic principle that I learned. Now you're not separate. This is you. This is the younger, original, innocent you. And your hearts are pounding together, and they sink in their heartbeat, and your breath sinks, and you become one with this child. And she espouses little bits of wisdom to you. I've been waiting for you, right? And you say, I'm sorry I've neglected you all these years. There's no need to apologize. But I want you to know I'm here. And I want you to live your life spontaneously. Dance like nobody's watching.
Sing along, do
silly things.
Play music.
Love yourself. Yeah. Fall madly in love with yourself. Fall madly in love with me. Right? And that just lights this fire. It's mainly women, but I've seen men just with sitting there immersed in this. Tears running down their eyes from these reunions.
Yeah.
And your listeners, this is such an easy process to do. And then there's some chat goes on, and then you say, and she says, listen, I've got things to do. I need to play. And off she runs, and she gets 20 feet away and turns around and gives you a cheeky grin and says, I love you. and's gone. And you can tap into this. If you're sitting at the traffic lights waiting for the lights, you can tap into this little child within
and
just be spontaneous. Yeah. That's the primary thing that keeps me young.
And that's so important, because life gets so serious otherwise.
It does.
And we get into a rat race of achieving and overachieving and doing more and achieving more and having more. And we lose the easiness and the playfulness of life when we don't connect with the inner child.
So that keeps my wicked British sense of humor alive.
Which has made me laugh a lot this week.
I dress younger, not because I'm trying to portray anything, but I dress colorfully, you know. The twin girls, 10 years of age, I relate so well to them.
I mean, these are your daughters. Like, I think we have to, you know, point that out, because you have become a dad with 63.
Yes.
Of two amazing twin daughters.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have a 39-year-old daughter in Australia.
Yeah.
So my parenting is very different this time around. It's much more conscious parenting. And it was a beautiful, beautiful chapter to my life, and is. It was life-changing for me. These kids are teaching, they're my teachers. They teach about patience and persistence. They teach compassion, right? They teach unconditional love. Right? They're my teachers. Right? I witness them. I see what they're doing, and they are mirroring the little child within me. So there's a difference between childlike and childish.
Yes.
Right? Childish is picking your nose and flicking your boogies at somebody. Childlike might be picking a spoonful of peas and flicking them at somebody. There's a very narrow difference between the two, but to be childlike and spontaneous.
So we all should be more childlike. And sometimes also childish.
Do silly things. Do things. You know, kids, boys with Superman t-shirts can climb on top of the chicken coop and believe they can fly. And girls, you know, this is not derogatory, but there's a princess in every girl. And there's dreams and aspirations. And we don't want to lose that.
And I have come across this recently, here in Bali, actually, as well. Like, I found that one of my main missions right now is to awaken my inner child again and to get in touch with it more.
Yeah.
So I played more guitar. I started dancing like crazy in ecstatic dance sessions and also in the meditations when there is some dancing involved in the meditations. Just getting out again, you know, out of myself, out of this self that I have created within and doing new things and trying new things and getting inspired. Being spontaneous. So it's a journey though.
It is a journey.
Very precious one.
The ego wants us in our comfort zone. As long as we are in a comfort zone, the ego is really happy. Right? But the moment you step out of that, my whole philosophy is life begins beyond the comfort zone.
Yeah, that is mine too.
But if you're in there and it's full of fear and you're there and everything's really comfortable, right? You're not really progressing.
Yeah.
You're actually retrograding. So every year I do something that's different. Mm. And I challenge myself. I've been on some amazing retreats here, a template series. I'll just go and do something. Last year was the 21-day vision quest. Mm. This year is stepping completely out of my comfort zone into this new project. Mm. So all that I'm always challenging myself outside the comfort zone.
Yeah.
And that's what kids do. You know, when you take the trainer wheels off the bike and you're holding that saddle, you know that the kid's going to come in at some time with barked knees and elbows and bloodied and crying and, Dad, can you put the wheels back on? No, son, we're going to keep going. You fall off the horse, immediately get back on.
Right. So there's something that comes up to mind that you shared with me this week when we talked about age and these topics. And you said, it's a belief that we can only get 80 or 90 years old.
Yes.
And you have got to let go of that belief.
Yeah. That was probably the first thing. I've gone through a lot of my life looking at what is my belief, not what my parents told me, right? I've adopted some, pacifism, for instance, but that was theirs. And now I share that value, so it's mine. But we get told a lot of things, right? And a lot of belief system and religion as well. Mm-hmm. And what I've done is, what is my belief? Is this real for me? Is this true? Is this my truth? And one of the things in terms of staying young is I got rid of the belief that we last 80 to 90 years, right? That's a belief system, and whatever we believe will affect our behaviors. I've been a vegetarian for years. We live in a completely toxic-free environment. I've moved away from toxic people, places, and circumstances. So I'm constantly working at how can I improve at a cellular level this body. And that means getting rid of any ancestral stuff, DNA interventions, belief systems that are being carried back for, and look at, allow nature to renew and regenerate this. So these bodies were designed to live to at least 120 years, at least. And then we can live longer than that, much longer.
So changing the belief system is where it all starts.
Yes.
Or becoming aware of the belief system that one has now and then making constant effort to change it day by day.
Yeah.
And you are such a great living example for how that works. And I'm very happy to be around and to be here.
Thank you.
And to spend time.
We're happy to have you here.
Thank you.
Really. It's a two-way street. I learn from you too, Jacob. I witness you doing your exercises, your meditation, your breathing. I witness your and feel your energy around. You know, you are actively pursuing more consciousness. And for me, consciousness is a universal solvent. It is a condition of this planet is being brought about by unconscious choices, primarily from unconscious leadership. So I teach conscious business and conscious leadership. How can we make more conscious leaders? How can we become more conscious ourselves? How can we make more conscious, responsible choices that will result in no harm to other people, to the environment, to the planet. And my Hopi philosophy I've adopted as a value 7 generations ahead. So I look at what impact are my choices and decisions having today on 7 generations ahead. Not these kids' lives or their children, but 7 generations. And that changes the whole picture.
Beautiful. And now it goes like it goes always when we two talk. We could go on for hours and hours and hours. And probably the most of our listeners would at some point either fall asleep or turn off.
You've heard my wife say nobody's found the off switch yet.
Rick, I'm so grateful for this conversation.
Me too.
So much value in it, so much inspiration to take away. And thank you for being you. Thank you for being here in the podcast. Thank you for having me in your heaven in Bali.
Thank you. Well, I hope there's something that your takeaways that your listeners can get from it. And I would invite them to put some of this stuff into practice. If it works, do more of it. If it doesn't, find something that does. And I'm very grateful for the opportunity to do this interview. But more than anything else, I'm very, very grateful for you coming into my life. So
thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you.
Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören. Schön, dass du dabei warst bei dieser Episode von 1000 First Steps. Wenn dich diese Folge einen Schritt weitergebracht hat, dann abonniere den Podcast, um auf dem Laufenden zu bleiben, und trag dich auch gerne für meinen wöchentlichen Newsletter ein. Den Link dazu findest du in den Shownotes. Ich würde mich auch sehr, sehr freuen, von dir zu lesen. Schreib mir auf Instagram @jakob.horvat oder schick mir ein Mail an mail@1000firststeps.com. Dein Feedback ist so unheimlich wertvoll für mich, weil es mir hilft, den Podcast weiter zu verbessern. Sag mir, was du dir aus der Podcast-Folge mitnimmst. Lass mich wissen, für welche Themen du brennst und wovon du gerne mehr hören möchtest. Denn dieser Podcast hat vor allem ein Ziel: Er soll dich weiterbringen. Er soll dich inspirieren und ermutigen, Schritt für Schritt zu dem Menschen zu werden, der du tief im Herzen bist. Wenn du mithelfen magst, dass noch mehr Menschen davon profitieren, kannst du 1000 First Steps eine 5-Sterne-Bewertung auf iTunes geben, deinen Freunden und Bekannten davon erzählen, einen Screenshot in deiner Insta-Story posten oder im Notfall auch gerne eine Flaschenpost verschicken. Ich bin Jakob Horvat, Visionscoach, Abenteurer und Autor von Weltnah, raus aus der Komfortzone, rein ins Leben. Das Buch über meine 14-monatige Weltreise mit vielen Tipps und Impulsen für deine persönliche und spirituelle Weiterentwicklung. Fast überall erhältlich, wo es Bücher gibt. Ich freue mich, wenn wir uns nächsten Mittwoch wiederhören. Bis dahin wünsche ich dir viel Liebe und Freude bei deinen nächsten First Steps.